everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at the Positive Mind, WBAI, 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Positively minded life? How could you be more positively minded than today? Well, let's not talk about that, but let's talk about the fact that people are frequently not prepared, ill-prepared, or over-prepared for disaster. I see some people who are so sure that the world is going to come to an end at any moment. And they're just scared, and they run scared. We're going to talk about that, but what we're really going to talk about first is a man who's a guest in the studio with me, Lawrence Gonzalez. Lawrence has written a book called Everyday Survival, but the subtitle really tells us the story, Why Smart People Do Not-So-Smart Things. Interesting. Not-So-Smart. What happened to people? How come sometimes people aren't prepared? And I think there's an interesting beginning to this. Lawrence, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you.
I thought the rattlesnake story was a good story at the beginning. Tell us about you and your ceramic rattlesnake.
Well, when I was a little child, my grandmother had gone to Mexico and gotten an ashtray that was made of ceramic, and it looked like a rattlesnake. It was very realistic. It was dusty, this old Mexican stone-looking effect. And I always thought that was a very cool thing to have. And I grew up around it, and I had lots of nice associations with it because it was in my grandmother's house. Many years later, as an adult, I was hiking in the Santa Monica Mountains above Los Angeles, and I came across the ruin of a stone house. It was all tumbled down except for the chimney. And I thought, oh, this is very cool. I'll search around in there, and I'll find some sort of souvenir to take home, like maybe an old tool or something. And so I was poking around in the stone rubble, and all of a sudden, there was my grandmother's ashtray, complete and unbroken. And I reached out to take it, and I saw its tongue come out. And I realized, of course, that the stupid mistake that I had made, trying to reach for a real rattlesnake, when I had, the most interesting part of the story is that I had the intellectual knowledge available to me that would have stopped me from doing that. I knew, for example, that the chances of my ever finding my grandmother's ashtray anywhere was approximately zero. I knew that I was in the high desert mountain area where rattlesnakes are common. I knew that they like to poke around in the stone ruins where the mice live. So all this intellectual knowledge did me no good in the face of this mental model of the ashtray that I had kept in my mind all these years unconsciously and invested with such nice emotional feelings.
I guess that's why many people fall in love with the wrong person. It's got to be related to it in some way. You know, you grow up. You have kindly people all around you, and you love all these kindly people, and you stop being cautious after a while. Then you go out of there, and let's say you visit Manhattan, and somebody comes along kindly, it's a rattlesnake. You know, you got to be a little careful every now and then. But people lose their cautions, and this is what your thing is about. And I think that, Lawrence, your book speaks to enormous amounts of information about why people handled the tsunami the way they did, why they handled New Orleans the way they did, why they stood by and let a government destroy us the way they did. I think it's all about what you talk about, which is about, you know, in effect going to sleep or being on vacation. So
right.
can we address that? I mean, I'm going to let you run with this one.
Yes, I think that one of the things I try to do in the book is I try to show how natural systems in our brains that we have inherited over millions of years of evolution work the way they're supposed to work, only the way they're supposed to work can sometimes lead us into trouble, just as I was saying about the rattlesnake. In fact, we do make these mental models. They're simplified versions of the world. If we didn't have them, you'd have to stop and investigate everything all over every
time. Give me an example of a couple of mental models.
Here's a very easy example for you. The sign for handicap parking has a symbol on it. And if you ask anybody what that symbol is, they'll tell you it's a person in a wheelchair. But if you look at it carefully, it looks nothing like a person in a wheelchair. It's just some lines put together. It's very abstract. But because of the way the brain makes mental models, it's easily identifiable. So we require very little information to successfully identify things in the world. This is a good thing. It's an efficient thing. But it can trick us, as I just showed with my rattlesnake story. We immediately latch on to the most familiar thing that we've stored as that mental model. So we have to be careful about that when we're operating in a modern environment. There's another type of system in the brain that's related to this for efficiency, and I refer to it as behavioral scripts. Psychologists will sometimes call it procedural learning, like tying your shoe. You don't have to think about tying your shoe. But if you try to teach a child to do it, it's very hard to do. It's a complex thing. You have to learn, and you have to turn it into a behavioral script. So it's a system that takes something that requires all of your attention and turns it into something that requires none of your attention, which is kind of a miraculous thing, and a good thing generally. But we also have, for example, a behavioral script for driving a car. So you can drive a car without thinking. Well, that's not necessarily a good thing. That's a dangerous thing. So we have to be aware of these systems in order to let them, in order to prevent them from controlling us in bad ways.
We're all aware of people when you're driving, those people who drive. I mean, I know I'm always alert to what's happening around me. I'm alert to the other driver. I'm looking at the driver in front of me and seeing if he's a good driver. I'm thinking about that. I'm actually thinking those terms. But then I also get, and I could be driving somewhere and I could be in back of a car where the person has no consciousness of anyone else and they're on their little vacation in their SUV and they're really asleep. And I mean by asleep, meaning that they just are in their world traveling along. They have no idea of what's going on around them.
Mm-hmm.
That is one of the dangers that you talk about. Let's talk about it on a much bigger scale. Let's talk about what happened to the airliner.
There's a chapter in the book about an airline crash, and it happened right after 9/11. Many people will remember that because there was a very striking image of a crane pulling the tail of the airplane out of the water. The plane took off from Kennedy for the Dominican Republic, and it crashed into a neighborhood on Long Island, and everyone was killed. It turns out that the way this happened was the co-pilot had developed a fear of a certain kind of turbulence. We don't know how he developed that fear, but he had developed an automated response to it, one of these behavioral scripts that I talk about. When he hit this kind of turbulence, he moved the rudders back and forth very forcefully to right the plane. If the wings tipped, he would try to untip them by pushing the rudder. This is a very bad thing to do in a large plane that's going fast.
But if you're in a large plane going fast, taking off from Kennedy, you're automatically in the downdraft of another airplane. Aren't you familiar with that? Is that what you call turbulence?
Yeah, it's the turbulence created by another aircraft. It's called wake turbulence, and you don't always encounter it. In fact, you're supposed to try to avoid it, but in this case, they did encounter it, and it scared this guy so bad that he hit the rudder pedals hard enough to tear.
Compensated for it.
Yeah, he tore the piece of the rudder off that moves, basically. And without that steering mechanism, the plane went into the ground and crashed, and everyone was killed. But this kind of automated behavior is what did him in. He didn't stop and think about what he was going to do in the face of this. In fact, if he had done nothing, it would have been fine. But he had worked out this automated behavior over a period of time. There were several incidents on the record where he had done this before with other pilots, and fortunately nothing bad had happened. And that's another thing that shapes these behaviors in us. If we do something and get away with it, it's like a reward. So you can do the wrong thing, and if you get away with it, that tells this system in your brain, that's a good thing, do it again, do it next time. This isn't a conscious thing. It just builds up pressure for you to behave that way. So I always say that when you say someone was experienced, you know, when there's an accident, they'll say, well, he was a really experienced mountaineer. The word experienced may just mean that he's done the wrong thing more times than you have, mm-hmm. and it finally caught up with him.
This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're speaking with Lawrence Gonzalez about our cautious self, about our sometimes absent cautious self. Lawrence is recommending that you be more alert because many of you are not alert, and then suddenly you get wakened. You know, it's an interesting thing, the metaphor of the airplane, for a few reasons, not only as a metaphor, but a reality. Number one, 9/11 happened first, and I remember when that plane crashed, and I remembered how much more alert people were and how much more responsive they were on the ground. And they were more alert and more responsive on the ground because of 9/11. People thought it was another crash.
Yeah.
And so I think what you're saying is the following. Once you wake up, you may become awake. But how do you get to wake up? And the other interesting thing about your story is, as tragic as it is that all those people died, all of those people were probably going on vacation in the Dominican Republic. And it was like an American plane going on vacation. And vacation is the state of mind that you talk about.
Yes.
That you need to be a little aware of.
Right.
What does it mean to be on vacation?
Well, in the prologue to the book, I talk about an experience I had in the Outer Banks of North Carolina while I was finishing the book. I went to a small state park called Jockey's Ridge State Park, which has some of the tallest sand dunes in the United States, some of them 100 feet tall. But it's also a place with a lot of little hills and trees and such and pathways. And I found at one point that I actually walked out there and got lost, even though the park is only a quarter mile wide and there's a big road there that you can hear. And so I stopped a ranger, a park ranger, and asked him, you know, do people really get in trouble here? And he just laughed and he said, yeah, they come here in a vacation state of mind and think all the old rules don't apply, like gravity. And talked about how people fall down the dunes because they forget that gravity still works when you're on vacation. It's like vacation calories don't count. And I like this idea of the vacation state of mind because I think it describes our culture in a big way. And I explain it in many different ways. One of the ways is, you know, if you wanted to train a dog, you might train this dog by getting a handful of treats. And when the dog did something you like, you give him a treat. When he does something you don't like, you say, bad dog. And pretty soon the dog's going to be reasonably trained. We live in a culture that rewards us every day, all day long, no matter what we do. You get up in the morning, you've fed, you've got coffee, there's entertainment all day long. You know, no matter what stupid things you do, there's a bunch of rewards for you. So what does this tell us? This tells the animal inside of our brain that our strategy is good. It tells you keep doing what you've been doing. That's what the reward means.
Of course.
And so if we don't have some system of deconstructing these brain systems that I'm talking about and thinking things through a little differently, we behave blindly.
That's why we produce these guys with the placards who say, the world is coming to an end. God will make you pay for your sins. In a funny way, you know, even though that could be his whacked out crazy stuff going on.
Right.
It's almost an alert to wake up.
Well, there's another effect, too, that you were mentioning 9/11 and how people became more alert. And I'm sure you'll know about this. You know, there are all kinds of people in New York City who were there that day on 9/11 who, if they see a bright blue sky day, get a feeling of anxiety because that's what the weather looked like. Well, we have a brain system that pairs things, almost anything. If a bad event happens, you can learn that a certain smell makes you feel bad because you just happen to be smelling it at that moment. And the same for good things. You know, you can learn to be attracted to things randomly by being rewarded at the same time. It's a sort of Pavlovian effect. So we have to be aware of this because it can either make us miserable, as in the case of post-traumatic stress disorder, or it can make us feel good when things are bad. There was a train crash in L.A. not too long ago where the guy was text messaging while he was supposed to be driving the train, and he blew a red light and killed a bunch of people. Well, he had obviously done this before, and it was a cool thing to do. It was something that made him feel good. So he paired a good feeling with a bad behavior, and the result was, inevitably, he was going to make a mistake.
I was in an automobile accident with a cab driver who was on the phone. And since then, you know, I've learned that, you know, being on the phone while you're driving your cab is illegal. You can't do it. But everybody does it. All the drivers do it because they're bored, because they're driving, because they want to talk to their honeys, or they want to talk to their friends, usually a language I don't understand. But I've just insisted you must put the phone down.
Right.
Because I got punchy. But something happened to me. I became alert. And I'm usually a kindly man who doesn't ask people to change their way of being. So you talk about a need for people to become three things. What are they? What are we looking for? We're looking for attention. We're looking for alertness. What are we looking for?
Yeah, I think that we're looking for, look, we've come all this way in our evolutionary history. Millions of years in the making, we have finally gotten to a culture where the fruit is always hanging low. You know, we conquered the main troubles of our ancient ancestors, which are how to get resources like food and water, how to protect against predators, and how to be safe from our neighbors so that we can reproduce and live happily. We really have accomplished that. It's an amazing thing. But that has lulled us into a sense of complacency because the world doesn't just dump all of its hazards when that happens. So we gave up paying attention. If one of our ancestors a million years ago lived a life of frantic anxiety because she might get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger at any moment, you know, that's not exactly the state we want to live in. We don't want to live in a paranoid state of fear. But we don't also want to just go through life talking on that cell phone and listening to that iPod and watching that television show and not thinking through the things that are around us. That's why people do things like get electrocuted by hair dryers, because they believe that everything in their environment is benign and they don't ever think it through. So attention and a new way of looking at your world is part of what I'm suggesting that people learn how to employ. And one of the things I do in everyday survival is to give people an acquaintance with basic natural laws so that they begin to look at their world a little differently and understand a key point of the book, which is that everything comes with a cost. Everything you do has some cost somewhere. It may not be a cost to you in the case of American society. It may cost somebody, you know, in a third world country who's making your iPod for you something. But everything comes with a cost, and everything comes with some sort of unintended consequence that you hadn't anticipated before. And so once you start to view your world in this way, the way that I try to portray in everyday survival.
Well, give me an example. Everything comes at a cost. How does this radio show come at a cost?
Well, the radio show is a good example because it's this very organized thing, but it produces a lot of chaos. As you run this radio show, someone somewhere is burning coal to make electricity, and that coal is putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and mercury into the atmosphere, which is a neurotoxin. So you are paying, everyone is paying for our ability to talk on the radio right now.
Hmm.
And
I'm shutting off the radio. somebody's paying.
But, you know, all of our culture is based on someone else paying. Not us, someone else.
Mm, we're beginning to learn that.
There's a chapter in Everyday Survival called the 10,000-watt light bulb. And the reason it's called that is because human metabolism takes about 100 watts of power. That's what a human uses. But in the United States, we use about 10,000 watts each. And that means it's the equivalent of burning a 10,000-watt light bulb 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And that doesn't come out of nowhere, that power that we use. It comes from someone else. It means there are other people who could be using that power who are not using it because we're using it. So we're taking the resources of many people. Each calorie that we eat in America costs 15 calories to get it to us and into us. So it's like we're eating for 15 people. So these are real things in the world today, and as we become more of a global village and as we become more aware of global warming and what its effects are, these effects will come back to haunt us. They aren't just going to happen somewhere else.
Okay. A man came to me, and he said to me, he was married to someone, or he had gotten married to someone who came to him every income tax day, and she brought him a shopping bag full of receipts. And he said to her, how could you bring me these receipts in this form? It's in a shopping bag. And she said, don't worry. The Lord always provides. So then he'd take all these things and he'd put them together and he'd do their taxes. And the next year she'd come back to him and she'd have a shopping bag. And he'd say, oh, look, you just put them back on the shopping bag. You're supposed to organize them. How could you do this? And she said, trust me. The Lord always provides. And he did it a third year. And then he came to a realization. He was the Lord.
Yes, and he was also training her very effectively.
And he was training her very effectively, of course.
Yes.
So what happens to us is we get into this complacency and we get into this non-awareness. But there's two points here, because for her, The Lord does provide. She lives a stressless life. She trusts everything. And nothing's ever happened to her. She's now late into her 60s. And she lives a fine life with no dangers ever happening. She lives in a gated community now, in a town where everything is safe and wonderful. And so why should she add any of the stress to her life? Why should she pick up her caution?
Because one of the things that I'm advocating in everyday survival is that we become critical thinkers. And what critical thinking means is that you don't just accept any nonsense that you're handed. If you're given something that looks too good to be true and you take it, you may be making a mistake because it may really be too good to be true. So if you take, for example, the way that the world has adopted computers is an example of this. We embrace computers so wholeheartedly, so completely, so thoroughly, so rapidly, without ever stopping to say, hey, you know what? This looks really too good to be true. What's the catch? Well, the catch is that, you know, you replace your computer every 2 to 4 years and you throw the other one in the alley. And the computer then is picked up and it's taken to a dump and it's taken to a toxic dump in Ghana where little kids pick it apart and burn the insulation off the wires and die of toxic metal poisoning. There's a big cost to these computers. Nobody ever stopped and said, hey, wait, do you have to replace the whole thing? Maybe there's a component you can replace in it, and you don't have to throw so much stuff away. Well, this is critical thinking. We didn't use that critical thinking. We just took it and said, when the next one came out, we took that one, too.
Oh, it's like bottled water. It's like people with bottled water. You know, we have all these plastic. Now we're going to drink all spring water, and we have all these plastic bottles.
People pay more for bottled water than they pay for gasoline at its highest price last summer. Now, this is a serious lack of critical thinking. This is, in fact, an economy that depends on us being stupid, too stupid to recognize that when you've got pure water coming out of your tap that anybody in a million countries in the world would like, that drinking bottled water is maybe not such a smart thing to
do. Or even filter the water if you're worried about it.
Or filter the water, right. So, but my point about critical thinking is that it poisons you in every way, because if you are not thinking critically enough to think about the computer or the bottled water, then you are not going to be thinking critically enough to reject the pernicious nonsense that our leaders have been forcing on us for years now, and say, hey, you know what? That guy's wrong.
Well, Lawrence, but I don't get it. Are you saying that you won't buy a computer?
No, I'm not. I'm saying that this is a system in which if I wish I could buy a component to replace in my computer instead of a whole new computer, but that in the course of developing this economy, it was in the best interest of certain people to make a whole lot of money by reselling you all the components at once every time.
You know what we need?
You
remember the old Mission Impossible? When you would listen to him, he would say, and your task, if you choose to accept it. And then he said, this will self-destruct in 10 seconds. We need self-destructing machines. But then again, if they do, they would send gases into the air. Okay, so there are two kinds of people. There are the people who worry a lot. And there are the people who, well, there's many kinds of people, but the two that I'm thinking about is some people don't worry at all, and they get by fine. Other people worry too much, and they don't get by fine. And you're saying somewhere in the middle here are three ingredients you're looking for. You're looking for people to have, number one, you want them to pay attention, right? And that means be alert, pay attention, and curiosity. How does curiosity play into this?
Curiosity is essential in this, and it's one of the things that, again, I think our culture discourages, and that is to question everything. When things happen in front of you over and over again, you tend to, as I said earlier, make these models of them that tell you basically, I already know what this is about, I don't have to think about it, I can keep going. There was a wonderful experiment done by the Washington Post. Joshua Bell is arguably one of the greatest violinists in the world right now. And somebody there convinced Joshua Bell to go play in the subway station during rush hour. And so Joshua Bell took his $3.5 million Stradivarius and went into the subway at rush hour in Washington, D.C. and put the case on the ground like they do and picked up the violin. And he played these six soaring musical pieces, these great, great performances. And 1,100 people walked by him during this 45-minute performance. Only seven of them even stopped to look. a few of them threw change in the case. He made Joshua Bell made $32 that day for that performance. But it shows you how these people have become so, they've worked out their mental models and behavioral scripts to the point that they could miss this chance of a lifetime without even noticing. And so, you know, they go into the subway and there's a guy playing violin. They don't think, wow, there's a guy who's playing really good. Maybe I should listen. Maybe I should find out more about this situation. They go to the mental model and the behavioral script, and it says, you already know what this is. It's a subway musician. Keep going. You're on your way to work. So it all happens unconsciously. Becoming more curious about your world in every way means becoming like my 5-year-old son. It's very hard to get him out of the house and off to school because he'll stop every few minutes and go, look, an ant, you know, or look, a garbage truck. You know, everything is interesting to him. It's all brand new. It's fascinating. That's a good state of mind to have. It slows you down. It costs your efficiency. But one of the things I say in everyday survival is that efficiency is not really always the best goal.
This is Armand DeMille with you. We're speaking with Lawrence Gonzalez. If curiosity is in itself the essence of survival, you know, if people, when they made love, were curious every time they ever made love, it would be a different story. You know, some of the things that happen in marriages, people get bored with each other because they lose their curiosity. They begin to get, you know, a little too complacent, and they lose interest. And we've learned that enough about the biochemistry of the brain that if you don't have new interest, if you don't have that, your brain's actually not functioning on a high level, and you could, you wind up going to sleep in a way.
Well, I'll tell you a perfect example. If you take a lion and put him in a cage and give him a steak every few hours, he's going to be a pretty bored lion, not very interested in his surroundings. If you take that same lion and put him in the jungle where he came from, he's going to be interested all the time because there's all kinds of things happening around him that could hurt or help him. And so the trouble, I mean, we've created our own trouble by solving our own problems, in effect. The culture that solves the very problems that you face in ancient times is the culture that dulls those senses that can help us. And so we're in a constant struggle to do that. But mindful awareness and curiosity are the tools that can help us in that quest.
How would people develop? I mean, the people who aren't curious aren't curious. You can't make somebody curious.
Well, I know what you're saying, and yet I have a lot of faith in human nature. And I think you can take some pretty... I have seen cases where you can take some people who are pretty... you know, unaware and not very curious and not paying much attention. And by chance, they got themselves into a horrible situation, like the World Trade Center,
for example. World Trade Center, sure. And everybody becomes curious every time they hear an airplane flying.
Well, and not just that, but that suddenly they go home and they re-examine their lives and they think, wow, there's a lot more to this than I thought.
It's a wake-up call.
It's a wake-up call. And, you know, I know people who've had car accidents that are cancer. You know, something shakes up your life. And you start looking at things differently.
Well, you know, we're going to have to take a short break. When we do, we're going to come back. We're going to talk about today's economy and how this relates to today's economy. My guest is Lawrence Gonzalez. The name of the book is Everyday Survival. And we're talking about the complacency that leads us to so often miss the big stuff when it's happening. We'll be right back with you, my friends.
We are. So wet, so gospel choir. And you are listening to BAI New York. BAI New York. San Bonani.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
the king of Bongo Bong. I went to the big town where there is a lot of sound, from the jungle to the city, looking for a bigger crown. So I play my boogie for the people of big city, but they don't go crazy when I bang it on my boogie. I'm the
king of the bongo, king of the bongo.
Hear me when I come, baby.
King of the bongo, king of the bongo.
Nobody like to be in my place instead of me, cause nobody go crazy when I bang it on my boogie. I'm the king without a crown, hanging loose in a big town. But I'm a king of bongo, baby. I'm the king of bongo bongo.
King of the bongo, king of the bongo.
Hear me when I come, baby.
King of the bongo, king of the bongo.
Hear me when I come. They say that I'm a clown, making too much dirty sound. They say there is no place for little monkey in this town. Nobody like to be in my place instead of me, cause nobody go crazy when I'm banging on my boogie. I'm the
king of the bongo, king of the bongo.
Hear me when I come, baby.
King of the bongo, king of the bongo.
Hear me when I come. Banging on my bongo, all that swing belongs to me. I'm so happy there's nobody in my place instead of me. I'm a king without a crown, hanging loose in a big town. I'm the king of bongo, baby. I'm the king of bongo bongo.
King of the bongo, king of the bongo.
Hear me when I come, baby.
King of the bongo, king of the bongo.
Hear me when I come. Mama was queen of the mambo, papa was king of the Congo. Deep down in the jungle, I start banging my first bongo. Every monkey like to be in my place instead of me, cause I'm the king of bongo, baby. I'm the king of bongo bong. Hear me when I come.
Hey, that's Bongo Bongo with Mano Chao. This is Armand DeMille back with you at The Positive Mind. My guest is Lawrence Gonzalez, and we're talking about everyday survival. You know, I was thinking, Lawrence, while we were on our break, that the people take drugs, and there was a drug population, alcohol. A lot of that is an attempt to quell anxiety.
Right.
What is anxiety? Anxiety is a state of alertness. And when the amygdala is firing and you're feeling very anxious, one of the things you want to do is rest. And so people try to rest by taking a sleeping pill, eating too much food, drinking alcohol, smoking some dope, or doing something to quell it. I think the people who are overexcited and overnervous are just as asleep as the people who are zoned out. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. And I think that one of the things that's happened since 9/11 is that the population has been sort of cynically manipulated into a state of high fear through all kinds of means. And that fear, once it motivates them to accept almost anything that will do away with the fear, that will give them comfort. So they're willing to go through nonsensical, pointless, and humiliating searches at the airport, for example, because they believe that there's some terrorist who's trying to hijack a plane, and there's this recording going on over and over again saying it's alert level orange or whatever. And this is just, I go back to my plea for critical thinking. You know, people should realize that they're being manipulated and this is all nonsense and it doesn't work anyway, and calm themselves down and start thinking clearly again. Because fear is just it's a very distressing state. It prevents you from thinking clearly. You mentioned the amygdala. When the amygdala starts firing, the frontal cortex, where we do our rational thinking, is shut down. And so the higher the level of stress and emotion, the lower the level of logic and reason. We can manipulate that ourselves. We can control it by practice.
Well, but now would you say at some point you take a stand, that you go and you're trying to get on an airplane and they say take off your shoes? Do you say, no, wait a minute now, I've got to make a difference here? I'm not going to take off my shoes.
Actually, my older daughter does that. They make her search her every time. But that's not my particular way of doing things. I think that people, as they listen to what their politicians are telling them, they will learn to listen to people who are speaking calm and rational, who are calm and rational voices in the face of this. They will not listen to people who are constantly instilling fear in them because, you know, in reality, there's no evidence that there's any risk of terrorism at all in this country. 9/11 did happen. It was a fairly small incident by global standards. A few thousand people were killed. A few thousand people are killed in all kinds of places all over the world all the time. And this did happen, and it's a frightening thing. However, there's no evidence that it's going to ever happen again. And there's no evidence that it's going to happen, you know, in an airport, for example. If you were a smart terrorist, you'd stay clear of airports. And yet people are terrified by this stuff. And it's only by electing officials who will be rational along with you that people will get the results they want.
Well, okay, so fear sells, right? We know fear. Fear has been the biggest, the bottom of all of our advertising for ages. You know, if they threaten you, your hair's going to fall out unless you use this product. Your people are not going to love you unless you brush your teeth.
Right.
This is going to happen. Fear is the motivating factor for people, but it doesn't motivate them to be awake. It motivates them to stand in line and follow the other guy and do just what they're telling you to do. Fear is not a good motivator.
Right. No, it's not. It activates in many people, not in everyone, but it activates an abdication of responsibility. You want to say, you know, just take care of me. You know, just take care of it. I don't want to know what you do. Just do it. That's not true of everyone, and you can develop a way of thinking that says to you, you know, in this modern age, for example, a post-9/11 age, it's well known that if somebody got up on an airplane full of people and started waving a knife around, he would be taken down very quickly by the people on the airplane. People now know about this type of threat, and indeed there have been a couple of incidents like that since 9/11. So if we're afraid of that, we've got our fear in the wrong place. You know, it's like people who are afraid of flying and yet drive their cars as if they're sitting in their living rooms. They don't have a very realistic appraisal of what the threat level is.
I keep meeting people in their 80s and 90s who fear aging and death so much that they spend all of their time, and their conversations are, I walked 2 miles today. I did this today. And they're just all about living for health only. It's a fear. And it's such a fear-based life that there is no other life but that. You're talking about something else. Since you addressed it and you got near it, let's talk about groupness and how you perceive groupness, one of the chapters in the book, Everyday Survival.
Groupness is a term coined by psychologists to describe the fact that people form in groups. Lots of animals form in groups, but in terms of people, these in-groups can be formed around anything. Your football team, you know, the people on your block, your religion, you name it, you know, your ping pong team. Once you form a group, it has certain characteristics. You create cultural norms for the group, certain ways of doing things. You may create jargon, lingo that you use inside the group that others can't understand. And you use these to create a boundary around the group that keeps others out and keeps your group in, and it also tends to reject information from outside the group. So people tell you stuff outside the group, you don't accept it as readily as someone who tells you inside the group. So it breeds a kind of insular thinking. This, long ago, would have had a good effect. When two groups meet, the default position is hostility. So a million years ago, two groups of, you know, proto-humans meet and they stay away from each other, or they fight, or in some way they clear the terrain so that they can ensure their own resources. But now these groups are forming in places like institutions and corporations and universities and political arenas, and they can have bad effects because they prevent information from flowing.
Well, wait a minute. What kind of a group are you talking about?
In institutional groups?
Yeah.
I'm talking about, well, an example that I use in Everyday Survival is NASA. When NASA crashed the space shuttle Challenger in the 80s, I believe it was 86, a bunch of people from the outside tried to help them, engineers from companies that made components and so forth, tried to help them to understand what had happened and to correct problems. And a lot of that information was just bounced off the NASA group. They had formed a very, very powerful in-group over the course of their history with the Apollo program, going to the moon. You know, they made huge sacrifices to get to the moon, and so they suffered pain together. They had a huge triumph getting to the moon, and so they had this great triumph together, which validated their view of themselves as the smartest guys on the planet. And so this very powerful in-group just rejected information that could have helped them. And then they went ahead and crashed the space shuttle Columbia pretty much the same way. I mean, it was basically the same scenario as the Challenger. It was technologically a different problem, but the way that they dealt with the problem was every time they launched and the problem happened and the space shuttle came back successfully, they said, well, we must be doing something right because it got back okay. And so they'd do it again. And instead of saying, wait a minute, there was a problem, and that indicates that we should reassess the whole thing, they just kept going and going and going, even when people outside the group were telling them to stop.
Where would groupness affect us in our everyday life? Like, for example, if I'm going, if I'm at a town and I'm somewhere out of town and I feel like I've got some loose time and I see a group moving towards an area, I'll follow that group because I know they're going where it's going to be good.
Yeah, well, that can happen, too. That's a slightly different effect from what I'm talking about, but that is describing the natural tendency of people to want to join the group, to want to be part of a group. And if you're disconnected from your group, you will try to connect with a group somehow, even if it's only temporarily. Someone wrote a book did a film about a group of women who... they did something like they all went to the bathroom on the Staten Island Ferry at the same time or some weird thing like that. They met in this bathroom on the Staten Island Ferry.
All the women?
It was a small group of women, but they formed this group around the Staten Island Ferry restroom or something like that. And it became this, you know, it was like something you would base a novel on. But it can be something incredibly trivial and transient to be in this group. And that's what all these little subcultures are, you know, where people fly model helicopters or whatever thing they do.
But the whole idea of the political environment and the world as we've known it for the last 8 years, the fear mongering and watching everybody go out and buying duct tape to tape up their windows, the idea almost is if I don't join the group, I'm not going to survive. If I'm not a part of the group, even if the group is doing wrong, I'm not going to survive. You say, Lawrence Gonzalez, you know, you got to question things, my friends. Don't question them with the kind of paranoia that says just because they're all doing it, it's wrong. But look at it yourself. Try to separate yourself from a minute and find your own mind.
Yeah, I'll give you an example of this kind of thing. I stay in a lot of hotels. I do a lot of traveling. When I'm in a hotel and it's 2 a.m. and the fire alarm goes off, I actually get up, get out of the room, go downstairs, and find out what's happening, because I would rather be downstairs on a false alarm for shivering in the street than upstairs in a real fire just because I ignored the alarm, you know. And it's mostly false alarms. I've never been in a hotel fire. It's all been false alarms. But while I'm doing this what I consider to be rational behavior, I see everybody else just ignoring it. And I wonder, like, well, are they all ignoring it because they don't want to seem like out of the group or be embarrassed by doing something silly?
Or maybe they've all come to this hotel before, and this hotel is known for its false alarms.
Exactly. So if they've been through enough, and I've been through enough to learn that lesson too, and yet I still keep leaving. When my daughters were little kids, 3 and 4 years old, you know, the smoke alarm goes off sometimes when you use your stove for certain things, and when it would go off, I would make them go outside. We would go outside. I would say, that's a fire alarm. It means you go outside. And we would actually go outside, even though we knew it was a false alarm. And then we would turn it off, and I'd say, when you hear that, you know, you go outside. That's the rule.
The name of the book is Everyday Survival, Lawrence Gonzalez and His Kids. So let me ask you something, Lawrence. The tsunami had a couple of few different groups in there. Some were asleep and some were not. And you have an expression called vacationing, which
yes.
I'd like you to go into.
The vacation state of mind I think, was very much in place during that event in 2006. There are plenty of videotapes that you can find that show this on the Internet, where people, you know, they get into this mindset that I've talked about before. We're on vacation, and they have this mental model of the place they are in Thailand. This is a vacation resort. They've also done things that make these models stronger, which is they paid a lot of money to get there, so they've invested something. The more you invest in a particular behavior, the more you're going to do it. And so there they are, and they see the wave coming. They can actually see it, and you can see them seeing it. And they just stand there talking and laughing, and as it comes, and it's not until the wave gathers around their feet and begins to knock them over that they realize actually what's happening, and the model that they have for this place changes suddenly. But I think an element of groupness played into that, because no one wants to be the first one to run screaming from the beach when you're all on vacation, right? And nobody quite knows what this thing is. The interesting contrast to that that I bring up in the book is this young girl, 10-year-old girl, who happened to have learned about tsunamis in geography class not too long before this and told her mother, look, you know, a tsunami's happening, because the water pulls out from the beach for about 3/4 of a mile before the wave hits, just like the smaller waves do, the larger waves do the same. And her parents were apparently remarkable enough to believe her, and they saved about 100 people's lives because they said, hey, that's a tsunami, let's get out of here, and they went to higher ground. So that's really the difference between, you know, thinking clearly and being curious about your world like that little girl was, believing the evidence of your senses when the senses deliver you something new, and then acting on that in a rational way.
I went to visit, I was in California. I stayed right on the San Andreas Fault. There was a bed and breakfast there. I stayed right on the crack. I thought it was so thrilling. Middle of the night, I'm waking up by shaking, or I think shaking, and rumble, 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 and I go, oh, my God, what an imagination I have. I'm going back to sleep. Next morning, I wake up, and it turns out they had one of their biggest quakes.
Oh, my.
But there I was in my mind saying that, you know, well, it can't be. It must be my imagination. And must be my imagination is a lot of that happens to people. You see, if you're a paranoid or worrisome type of person, you got to stop believing all the cautions in your mind. It'll drive you crazy. I know a man who is convinced that there's going to be a disaster over the next few months and that he is taking care of himself. He has guns. He has gold. He has a place to bring his children. He's convinced. I can't tell him he's wrong. He is sure the world is going to come to an end, and he's been talking about this for a long time, and people have been mocking him for a long period of time. They've been just saying, no, you know, this can't possibly happen, and there's something wrong with you. So at some point, he suffers for this belief. How do you know when you got something to really worry about and don't?
Well, he's right. The world could come to an end. Most people don't think sure. about this because it's such a remote and uncontrollable possibility. But it's perfectly within the realm of scientific reality. You know, an asteroid could hit the Earth. By the time we found out about it, it would be over, in all likelihood. So what's the point of worrying about that? I mean, you could drop dead of a heart attack, too.
Well, let's go to religion. So, in some religion, we'll tell you that God is watching every moment, and God is going to end this world and come back in any minute now, and he's going to judge the bad guys and the good guys, and you're going to be one of the bad guys.
Okay.
Now, what's the point of worrying about that? Well, you've got a whole religion with millions of people built on this fear.
Yeah. Well, that's something
Are you saying hogwash?
Well, that's something that I don't subscribe to, that particular view of the universe.
You don't like formal religion.
I'm not a religious person. I don't go to a church.
You could always tell a guy who wants to sell a book.
I believe in the universe the way I describe it in Everyday Survival, which is the scientific view of how the universe works that we know.
So God's not going to come down and do the punishment.
I don't think so. That is what I think. Other people can think whatever they want.
Lawrence Gonzalez, the atheist, agnostic.
As long as they don't make me...
You just sold another 500 books.
As long as they don't make me believe what they believe, you know. This is the difference between, you say there's two kinds of people in the world. There are those kind of people in the world who want to make everyone do what they do. And those kind of people who want to let other people do what they
want
to do.
I want you to fear what I fear is a big deal.
Yeah, it is.
People
absolutely.
Go around with that all the time.
But well, you have to take a long evolutionary view of fear to get a good grip on it. You know, a million years ago, fear served a purpose. You know, the lion jumps out at you, your amygdala fires off, it causes you to run into a cave, and you save your life. But then it's over. It stops. The stress is gone because you're safe and it calms down and you metabolize all those chemicals and you go back to a baseline. In modern society, the stress just keeps coming and it keeps coming and it doesn't let up and you get ulcers and you get crazy people who stockpile guns. You keep stressing somebody long enough, all of these systems are going to go haywire because they were only meant to operate for a few minutes at a time. And bursts of activity that involve fear were good. The life we live sometimes in this culture where we're fearful all the time is not good.
Well, I'm not sure that the people who stockpile the guns out of fear are the people who I would call crazy, but I would certainly call them scared people and maybe in the wrong direction. You think our old survival mechanism that we had, which is we still keep, I mean, we all have the same brain that was the brain of our ancestors. It's not very different. So we still have the survival mechanism. We've just put it to sleep.
Right.
We put it to sleep, which is what led us exactly to where we are now in the economy. We were asleep. I mean, what happened? What happened to caution about credit cards, about loans, about owning houses that you can't afford? Where was that? Where was that thing?
Right.
Somehow, we were put to sleep. And I'll bet it was a combination of things. Fear about something bigger like invasion and all the other stuff helped us get our mind to be more misdirected, directed on that thing that could hurt us while we collaborated and participated in something that could really hurt us.
Yeah, and there's a chapter in Everyday Survival where I describe the change that happened in my lifetime, in your lifetime, from roughly World War II until now, with the introduction of more and more conveniences, devices that would make our lives easier. The whole 1950s and 60s television advertisement of, you know, the housewife with her dishwasher and all of that stuff, that image of America, the new car every 3 years, the new television every 3 years, that entire image of what we did contributed to this. Because on the one hand, we had fear to distract us from real thinking. On the other hand, we had all this cool stuff to kind of lull us into complacency. We no longer had to get up to change the channels anymore. We could just relax and as you say, if you like, take drugs. But I think that combination of things sort of put us to sleep. And we're going to have to wake up. I mean, it's going to come. If we're not waking up right now, it's going to come and shake us awake pretty soon. If it hasn't already by the time of this election, you know, then we're really comatose.
How does that awake manifest? Is it you get more nervous or you just become more alert?
You start to look at things around you and say, you know what, that's BS. I don't believe that. You know, you look at the television, turn on your television and watch some pharmaceutical company advertise prescription drugs to patients.
Mm.
Now, why is a drug a prescription drug? That's because a doctor needs to prescribe it, and we assume that the patient hasn't gone to medical school for 6 or 8 years to learn what you need to know to prescribe this drug. So why sell it to the patient? Because fear. You know, you scare this patient enough about the condition he has, you can get him to go demand it from his doctor and up your sales. That's really cynical. So people need to be able to sit in front of their television and say, you know what, I don't believe this stuff anymore.
Well, you know, it's our time. We have to be going. Our guest is Lawrence Gonzalez. The name of the book is Everyday Survival. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind on WBAI. We'll end this with a little Joshua Bell doing the Four Seasons. You can go to thepositivemind.com and you can hear today's program, or you can go to WBAI.org, my friends. Be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. with Bernie Starr, and hopefully good news.
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Coming up next at 2 p.m., The Arts Magazine.